Welcome to 4.0 to Pro, the pickleball podcast that focuses on a single shot, tip, or strategy to improve your pickleball game with every single pocket-sized episode. Our goal is to make you better on the court every time you hear our voices. And now your hosts, 4.something Michael O'Neill, and USA Pickleball National Silver Medalist, Senior Pro Scott Fliegelman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of 4.0 to Pro, your pocket-sized pickleball podcast, where we teach you a single shot or strategy every single episode. I'm Michael O'Neill here in sunny Long Beach, California, joined by my good pal, Mr. Scott Fliegelman, there in Boulder, Colorado. Hello, Scott.
Hey, Michael. How are you today?
I'm very well. I'm excited for today's Q&A show. We haven't done one of these in a little while. And I don't know, it's one of my favorite kinds of shows to do here on the old pod. So I feel like we should dig into it, answer some questions, and have some good discussions.
I love to read through the questions that are submitted. It's really just cool to see the interaction that you guys have with us, and you're giving a lot of thought to what we're putting out there. So thanks.
As always, guys, if you want a carbon paddle, CRBN, carbonpickleball.com, use the promo code 402P at checkout and get 10% off of that carbon order. They got shorts, which I just got an order of. They got a brand new bag. I'm not sure if it's out to the world yet, but it will be out soon. It's kind of a gray tournament bag, which is very cool, and hats and glasses and everything you can possibly imagine to play pickleballs.
Michael, have you figured out that the new team bag, the gray bag, has a removable sling bag? Because it's sneaky if you don't know.
Yes, I've never removed it. I saw Garrett last night at Lost Cab, and I'm still in his ear about, I want one clip-on line that is removable. So it's attached on one side and clips on the other that you can disconnect to put wristbands and headbands and such on, just like they used to do with racquetball bags. So you could like dry your wristbands and things on the outside of the bag.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool idea.
That's my recommendation. I just hope he takes it one of these days.
You may have to do it yourself.
I may. I'll call it the mic clip or something and have to show it to him. I could probably do that. I could probably take it to any place and they would do it.
Yeah. You know? Toss it on makeemhit.com.
That's right. That's right. That's very true. Or have our good buddy JJ Collier sew it up for me and fire it back. All right. Questions today, boys and girls. We're going to dig into this. I don't pre-read these a ton. I just go, all right, this one seems like a good one. Let's go for it.
Be able to discuss these things without too much advance work, right?
Correct. That's the idea.
That's what they're paying us for.
That's exactly right. Taryn asked, Taryn's one of my favorite names, by the way.
That's a cool name.
It is a very cool name.
Are we thinking female? Do we even want to go there on this show?
Probably not. How does a player defend the third shot drip? And I'm not sure if that is the actual name. I do like it a lot, which is we call it the new school third, the hybrid drop drive. How does a player defend the third shot? She's calling it a drip. I'm calling you a she. I'm sorry, Taryn, if that's not the case. How does a player defend the third shot drip that lands at the feet of the player coming in? That shot usually results in a pop-up that is destroyed. Thanks and love, love, love your podcast. I think it's probably a female because she said love, love, love. And I don't know a lot of dudes that do that. One suggestion, can you make them daily? On it.
No.
It's a fair question, Scott. It is something that you are a card-carrying member of the new school third. Someone has hit a serve. Someone has hit that return back to the servers. And your advice much of the time is to hit this kind of 60% drop drive to the player that's coming in to the non-volley zone at their feet. So they're getting an ankle-high, knee-high ball. What do you do when you're that player coming in? How do you actually take that ball? I think it's a very good question.
It is a great question. And fortunately, I get to address this topic every single 3-and-me lesson that I play in because I hit this shot pretty regularly. Again, it starts with a nice deep serve. I'm trying to impact the returner to delay their forward progress, which makes this drip or new school third shot more effective than if they're standing at the non-volley zone. So let's switch gears and give some coaching to the returner who is getting stuck dealing with this drip ball coming at their feet. You hit your return and begin moving forward. Reminder that we have the time when the ball leaves our paddle, until it gets to the other side, their paddle, to adjust our court position. I suggest that they move swiftly, but not impatiently toward the non-volley zone, and make sure that you get a really nice pronounced split step in the transition zone. Frequently, that's 4 or 5 feet away from the non-volley zone, and that's just when the hitter of the third shot is making contact. I offer two pieces of advice from there. Recognize that that ball is going to drop at your feet and step on the gas and get in and get it out of the air. Or B, and this one frequently my students look at me a little funny when I say this, is hit the brakes and stay 5 or 6 feet away from the non-volley zone and let that ball come up to knee or waist high and play it from a much more relaxed position. The hitter of that new school third is hoping that it eats you up right on your shoelaces. You have some control over that if you make a pronounced split step in the transition zone and read accordingly.
Is it possible to retreat a little bit and give yourself a millisecond more time, or is it coming in with a little bit too much velocity?
I'm not a big fan in completely retreating, but I don't mind the use of a pivot foot.
Right.
So if it requires just kind of swiveling a little bit to get out of the way, let it bounce and pivot, then we can play that near waist high ball and likely just dink and move on from there.
Really great question. Thank you, Taryn. Matt asks, essentially, what are the strategies you can employ when you're playing with a much weaker player who are popping the ball up a lot? And I think probably, Scott, this dovetails into what you suggested to me when I played that last tournament, which was when you get your opportunities, take advantage of your opportunities. So a longer point doesn't serve you very well, because the more opportunity the opposing team has to hit to the weaker player, the more they're going to do that. So you may have to be a little more offensive than you typically would, just because you probably need to end these points a little earlier.
Yeah, I love that. We can address this really good question a couple of different ways from a team standpoint, and also individually if I'm coaching this weaker player on his or her pop-ups. Let's just take it both ways. I love your point that this Matt who submitted the question is the better of the two players and needs to value his touches more, being consistent, extending the rally, hitting really nice dinks. Now's not the time for that, because clearly your weaker partner is popping up balls when he or she is being targeted. You're going to need to value your touches, probably instigate and see if you can get a pop-up from your opponents before your partner does. Let me offer another suggestion. I've done this for mixed as well as men's, as well as for gender doubles when there's a stronger and weaker player, is let's encourage your partner to become an active earnier. Your opponents are probably picking on your partner, and it's pretty predictable that they're coming back to them. Let's teach them to slide up the sideline and at least threaten Ernie. What happens there is they either get an Ernie or you get more balls. We can see this with pro pickleball on TV every weekend. This is a really active strategy and works well for the 3-0 to 4-0, 4-5 as well. And then lastly, if I were coaching your partner, a lot of these pop-ups have to do with a lack of balance. I'd be watching them squat and lunge and encouraging them to be doing some off-court work to get a little stronger so that when they get down for a ball, the shoulders aren't tilting, that the knees are soft and they stay balanced and level. That's probably what's going wrong here.
Scott, I brought a good friend of mine to the pickleball courts who was a very beginner player, had been playing probably 10 total times, and brought her to Lost Cab, which is our local club, 39 courts. It's where many pros train. There's always 5-0 coaches, 5-0 pros playing. And I encouraged her, watch a few of these points. These were 4 5-0 plus players. I go, just watch their feet. Just watch the split steps. Watch the balance. And I said, now look at these courts. And we were closer to the 3.0 to 4.0 type challenge courts. And I said, can you identify why the error has been made? And when we really looked at the two courts in contrast, 90% of the errors that were coming from the 3.0 to 4.0 players were because they were hitting the ball off platform. They weren't balanced. They were hitting it off of 1 foot. They were running through a shot. They weren't splitting. They weren't in that stable base that we always talk about. It's the reason why I harp on it so much. I want you guys to be on the court like you're an Egyptian pyramid every time you hit the ball. Be so stable because it eliminates variable. And if we can eliminate variable in our shots, you're going to be more consistent with the ball. And if we can just think about stable base, split step, stable base, most of the time we're on the court, we're going to make far less errors than we would otherwise. So I think that, Scott, is awesome advice.
I think that is awesome advice. I especially appreciate you clarifying the pyramids were from Egypt.
Yes.
Yes.
Am I incorrect about that?
No. Well, the New Jersey pyramids are not the right ones.
Well, there's Mexican. That's true. Yeah, the Tecumseh pyramids aren't nearly as famous.
Or Yardley, PA. That's not a good pyramid in Yardley.
Michael states, Michael, don't ever listen to a podcast. He's talking to himself, I think. Don't ever listen to a podcast, then go play and try to do what the podcast is teaching without ever practicing it. I listened to show number 56, which is the show we did on really accelerating that last millisecond, that snap on the ball, Scott. And all I succeeded is doing is hitting the balls everywhere. The group I was playing with looked at me like I was playing with my opposite hand. I think I'll use the ball machine for a few days next time. And then the follow-up to that, which is another mic, ironically, the guy says, hey, is your snap/1-inch punch similar to the windshield wiper type wrist rotation, or are you using more of a full arm with a little wrist rotation? Thanks. I will tell you, Scott, that one of the biggest differences in my game over the last month or so has been trying to adopt the Scott Fliegelman wrist flick on my drops, and they've gotten more consistent, and they're doing more work. I'm watching more of a dip on the ball, actually in drives and drops. I think the answer to, is this more of a windshield wiper or more of an arm movement with a wrist thing, may be individualized. I'm currently doing a little more of a windshield wiper wrist flick thing. I'm using a lot of years of racket sport in there. Maybe you start with the more of a full arm with a little wrist flick, and then you start adding more wrist as it becomes comfortable. I don't know. You tell me.
Well, if Mike were in front of me right now, I would ask a clarifying question because I'm a little confused whether he is visualizing himself hitting a backhand or a forehand. The 1-inch punch, Bruce Lee 1-inch punch video and concept is pretty specific to the forehand dink or moving back in the court. The forehand drop that you're visualizing, and I appreciate the compliment that that's something that I hit well and is replicable. I'm kind of thinking Mike is thinking backhand when he uses words like windshield wiper type wrist rotation. I'm not 100% sure. On the forehand, I don't think windshield wiper. I think opening the doorknob in a counterclockwise manner. That would be the image that I would offer. But maybe Mike can get back to us and let us know if he's thinking forehand or backhand. But the image I'm going to offer is opening the doorknob. And for those of us with two-handed backhands, you're going to open the doorknob with your top hand. So that's for righties, when we get that two-handed backhand going, my left hand, I'm going to open the doorknob in a clockwise manner with my left hand. Frequently, a light bulb goes off with my students when I offer that direction. So, Mike, let us know if you're thinking forehand or backhand.
For me personally, Scott, the other thing that I visualize, even though I think when I view it on video, it's not nearly as extreme as I think it is I'm really thinking about dropping my paddle face so the top of the paddle is facing the ground. So the handle is almost vertically up. That's what I'm thinking before I hit the ball. Now, does it get that vertical? I don't know in real life. But when I drop that paddle face where I pronate my wrist and let the thing drop and then really focus on coming around with that 5 to 11 spin that we talk about on a forehand, I'm talking about right now, I'm tending to get the shape that I expect to hit with that ball. And it is a little bit more wristy than I did a couple of years ago. And that's just something I'm experimenting with now. I think probably the consistency comes from some combination of that arm and that wrist. And I think it's probably tailored to suit.
So let's keep talking forehand on that a little bit, offering Mike and Michael a little bit more feedback. I very much appreciate you're visualizing dropping the head of the paddle, getting that handle to face the sky or the ceiling a little bit more. When that's not happening, I'm frequently going to ask you, what's your grip tension right now? What's your wrist tension right now? Probably higher than I would like to see. And as soon as you relax one or both of those, the paddle head is now more free to drop a little bit. And if it's still not dropping as much as I'd like to see, you're probably in a full-on continental grip, which doesn't really allow the paddle face to drop as well as an Eastern forehand grip. So those of you out there trying to replicate some of these techniques with continental, there's probably a limit to how much spin and shape and Z's you're going to be able to get on this dink. It may be worth moving towards Easternental or toward Eastern forehand. Maybe make this a 4 to 6 month process because it's not going to happen overnight, which goes back to Michael's comment about let's maybe practice some of this stuff on a ball machine, specifically this skill, before putting it right into play. This one's a little tricky to do without practicing first.
It's tricky and it's advanced. We're talking about a nuanced tweak to a shot that we have to hit all the time, which is that typically third. There's some version of a third in here that I think probably represents the shot the most. And it could be a drop, it could be a drive, it could be a hybrid. But the ultimate result of getting this correct is getting the ball to shape the way you envision it before you hit it. And I think we're in the 4-7-5 plus range as we start tweaking this very nuanced shot.
And flipping back over to the backhand real quick on related note, I have given multiple shout outs to my friend and frequent playing partner, Jill Braverman, as one of the most beautiful, buttery, two-handed backhand dinks and drops. And it's really good. So check hers out. But there's another player who I had a chance to do some warm-ups with in Miami a week or two ago. Eva Radzikowska has a really lovely two-handed dink and from the midcourt and from the baseline and really gets that pad up nice and vertical. And then I think finds the 7-to-1 swing path that you and I talk about a lot for that two-handed backhand. And it's got the Z's on it. It's got the top spin, a little bit of side spin, and it has shape. It clears the net and it dips. So check out Eva's two-handed backhand when you get a chance, you guys.
You'll have to Google that. I don't know how to spell it. Question, is a 4.0 75-year-old the same as a 45-year-old 4.0? How could that be? The obvious differentiators are foot speed, reaction time, vision, etc. How do you know where you stand when you're older? Again, I think a great question. I have drilled and played with some people that were much younger, especially singles, Scott, where I'm playing a 33-year-old 5-0 player who's 6'4 and going, all right, I got 7 points. That feels really good to me because a mid-50s 5-0 player would not have the wheels that this guy did to get all of these balls. Many of the shots I hit probably would have been winners in my bracket. It kind of begs the question, how do you rate a group of people that are so potentially different than we have in all of these different age brackets?
I think the answer is it certainly depends. And one of the elements that it depends on is the integrity of the rating system in question, which our questioner did not specify. But if we had one of our friends from Duper on the show helping answer this question, well, they would certainly make a case that it doesn't matter what their age is, that their rating derived from playing against a range of other opponents is what it is, regardless of which elements of the game they're particularly strong or weak at. So I'm going to go ahead and say the younger player has achieved their 4-0 rating with athleticism and foot speed and length and power and all of those things that the 75-year-old player lacks. But the 75-year-old 4-0 has gotten to be a 4-0 by beating 3.9s, probably without all of that athleticism that the younger player has. So they are likely very consistent, very smart on the court, a wonderful partner, a student of the game, has a great intellectual understanding, great shot selection, efficient court positioning. Shall I go on? So I'm going to fight back a little bit and say, are they different? Of course they're different, but they've used different sets of skills to achieve a very likely similar rating.
That makes tons of sense. I was also thinking it might tighten up a little bit as you move through the ranks, because I think when you watch a split age pro event, Scott, where all of you guys are 5-0 plus, 5-5, et cetera, et cetera, I do think the gap narrows considerably in terms of overall talent level. I think everybody has all the shots. Yeah, there's a little bit more athleticism, but no one's going to look at your game and go, oh, that guy can't move on a court. Like, you look very good moving around a court, much like the probably in their 20s person you're playing with. So I do think it can narrow a little bit. So maybe on the earlier sides, the 3-0 to 4-5, it has to do a bit with the technical skill sets where you're actually learning the shots and being proficient at the shots. And then as you get closer to that 5-0 pro level, maybe the gap narrows a little bit. That's my hypothesis.
Well, I'm excited to give this some more thought over the next week or so, because I've recently been asked to sit in the announcer's booth at the US Open for split age mixed pro day. And this is going to be a key topic. We've got some really good players on the court. Now, we've got mixed, so a male and a female player. And then we've got a pro over 50 and a pro under 50. So this topic is really going to come right to the fore. And I'm going to go ahead and give some additional thought about ways to commentate and provide good color commentary while I'm sitting in the booth with Rusty from the Pickleball Channel. It's going to be a good time.
That's fantastic, man. Congratulations. I love that.
Thank you.
Barry asks, hey guys, love the podcast. Have you talked about what percentage of the time one should be looking at to play against better players, against players of a similar skill, and playing against less skilled opponents, as well as strategies or things to work on in each scenario? I'm going to start with this one, Scott, if you don't mind. This is a bit close to what I'm experiencing right now. And I will share a couple strategies that I'm currently employing to deal with all of these different scenarios. I have a regular group that I play with. And as I've gone through the last few years and I've really been a student of the game, I've seen my game grow past many of the people I started with now 4 years ago, almost 3.5 years ago. I still really enjoy playing with them. And I'm not good enough where I have to put what you call, Scott, a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit on that. I still have to play. But while I'm playing with them, and I'll say that I'm just, at this point, I'm a better player than them on the court. But what I think about is I start trying to think about getting out of my own reactive head. And I really start thinking about the lessons and the things that we talk about on this show. So I'll do a game where I'm like, I want you to focus on making sure you split step in the kitchen every single time. And I just will have those kinds of things. So I'm kind of running through, I don't want to say drills, because it's not that easy for me. It's not like I just am playing left-handed, but I am thinking about being technically sound as I play those games. If I am on a rec court, and this happened yesterday as well, I got on the court with some, you know, 3.0 type players, 3.5. And in that case, I did have more of a 5-mile-an-hour speed limit, and I was keeping it in play a little more. I was deferring to my partner a little bit more to take some of the balls. And that was fun. And again, trying to be technically sound. If there was an opening and I could hit a really great dipping third that went like under someone, I would take it. Like, I would do a nice third shot hybrid shot because I want to work on that. And my footwork and the shot's going to be the same no matter who I'm trying to play. Now, as for the more advanced version, I'm at this situation, Scott, where I'm up against a bit of a ceiling. I'm in no man's land. It doesn't always serve me to play with some certain groups at my local club. But I'm also not in with the in crowd of more advanced players at my club yet. I'm sort of in this spot where, I don't know, I feel like I kind of haven't earned my stripes. They don't know me well enough yet. So what I've decided to do, and what I'm going to suggest that you guys do, is if you are at a club where you sort of look longingly at a couple of courts for some better players, and you're like, I think I can hang with these guys, but I'm not getting the invite. If any of the players on that court are a coach at your club, or the coaches at your club are really integrated with that group or those groups, start coaching with them. So I'm now, Scott, looking at two different coaches here locally that I can work with on a regular basis, partially because I want to just have a regular drilling coach that I get better. But the other part is I think it's going to open up some doors for better playing partners in my local area. And I think that's worth the investment for me.
To clarify, you'll take some lessons from those coaches?
I'll take some lessons from the coaches.
Okay, good.
And that way I'll become a known quantity to them so that when those groups are on the courts, he'll go, oh, this guy's got a game. Come join us. And I don't know if that's going to work, but I do feel like it's probably a pretty decent strategy.
I think it's a good strategy, and I'm sure there's a bunch of you guys out there that are in a similar position, and so maybe you'll borrow from Michael's advice on that. Let me answer this question from Barry by starting with, I hear way too frequently, the only way to get better is by playing against better players. And I couldn't disagree more. Because I coach pickleball every day, when students leave my court, talk about what's next, what can you do for homework. You know, I'll point them toward the ball machine. We'll talk about maybe writing down some notes after the lesson. But then I frequently refer them to, do you have the opportunity to play down, to play a half level lower in the next couple of days? Because what better low anxiety environment to practice your new techniques in than when you're the best player on the court? Which you just described, Michael, quite a bit, is let's not just do nothing and play down to their level, which we've all done. Let's put a focus on, hey, what am I working on right now? This is a great opportunity for me to work on these skills and tactics in a lightly competitive environment without worry about the score, because you can always get to 8-8 and turn up the heat and win the game if that's important to you. Conversely, when you are the worst player on the court and you are playing up, this is not a great time to relax and work on your new skills. I can vividly remember playing rec with Dylan Frazier, Pablo Tellez, and Gabriel Tardio. I can assure you, I was not focused on my latest new school third or latest tip or tactic. I was just in awe and hanging and just doing everything I could to observe what they were doing and try to absorb and adapt and pick up some tips from those guys and hold my own. It was fun. I got better, but it wasn't a great time to incorporate some of my latest areas of focus. So long answer to your great question, both. Can we give you an exact percentage? No. But both of them are super valuable for getting better at pickleball.
One thing, Scott, that I realized lately, and this is one of the cool things about pickleball, is I'll get on this court and I'll hit a few shots that isn't in their arsenal yet. They're still on the timeline, working their way up. And we'll finish the game and they'll be so complimentary and supportive. They'll be like, wow, it was really fun playing with you. You're really good. Like something like that. People seem to really like playing with a really good player because it shows them what the potential of their game could be. I have a question for you, Scott. Let's say you're in one of those situations and you witness someone doing something very easily correctable over and over, and they keep missing the shot. Where do you stand on unsolicited coaching after a game? Or in the way that I might do it, I say, can I offer a quick thing that I observed or something like that? Where do you stand on that?
I stand not all that willing to offer unsolicited advice, but frequently.
Is that only because you're paid for it?
No, I'm thrilled. Like, I can't turn it off. Like, I would very much want to share the advice. It doesn't come up all that often because a lot of those players preemptively will say what you have said to me. Like, if you see something, say something.
Yeah, right.
They go ahead and open the door. So for those of you out there who are in this position, it may be more comfortable for everybody if you let them say something that gives you permission to offer advice, because now it's not unsolicited, it's solicited. Yeah. So otherwise, I tend not to unless I'm invited.
I find myself, though, between the two of us, I'm going to be on a court much more often with strangers than you are. You're going to be a known person 95% of the time you're on a court. So someone's not going to know that. I wonder if the reverse could be true, where you get on a court with someone who's really, really good, and maybe this is something you guys could employ. If you're lucky enough to get them on the court for a couple of games, maybe after the first game, be like, hey, you know, I really love your game. It's really great. If you notice anything about my game that's easy to correct or something I can fix, would love your input on it. And maybe they'd be happy to do it. I don't know. I think it, if you're a student of the game, you're trying to get better at something, I don't think it ever hurts to ask when you have played with a really good player, like, what did you see when we were out there? Anything you want to, that I should take home?
Yeah. And my perspective on that is that they're not asking me for free advice. I'm thrilled. I want to offer the advice, but I'd like to be invited to do it. So you guys out there, take Michael's advice on that and open the door for that better player to offer you something. They're not very likely going to take it as you're trying to get a free lesson out of them. So don't worry about that. Just let them know it's cool if they want to share something with you.
Dave Box says, hello, love your podcast. So helpful. I'm going to start playing singles. I'm reiterating that. I use a Yola Radius in doubles, thinking Yola Hyperion for singles. Thoughts? And then tips on singles play. That's a whole episode, which we've done, actually, Dave. My first instinct on this, Scott, is to not change paddles for singles when you're just starting to play singles. I think you should play with what you have and what you're comfortable with. And then if you find that you need something different, then you find a paddle that matches what you're looking for. But that's just my quick and dirty Twitter version.
I've gone back and forth over the years of having a dedicated singles paddle. My dedicated singles paddle was 1 or 2 ounces heavier, more weight towards the top of the paddle because I was less concerned about hand speed. I wanted it to feel like more like a racket and help me produce better ground strokes. And it may have been the more powerful model in my quiver, perhaps the X series in carbon versus the control series. I've done that in the past, that I hit some beautiful ground strokes. The downside was I found that my style of play still required a healthy amount of my double skills in the transition area, cat and mouse at the kitchen. And I didn't quite have the right weapon in my hand, nor did I have the comfort to hit with the finesse and control compared with the doubles paddle that's in my hand 90-some percent of the time. So these days, I've gone back to one paddle for everything. Are my ground strokes and my serves and returns as powerful? No, not quite. But my overall game is better. I'm able to hit the drops. I'm able to hit the finesse shots. And I just have a weapon in my hand that feels really familiar. And I can relax and be comfortable with that familiar paddle. So that's my current thinking, but you could go either way.
Played some senior pro singles yesterday, Scott, a couple of games, and I didn't want to. It was a buddy of mine who actually played that Tustin tournament with us. And he said, oh, come play some singles. I'm like, oh man, it's going to hurt. I just wasn't ready for it. And sure enough, I said, I'll warm you up. And as soon as I warmed him up, we hit a bunch of grounds. So I was like, all right, I'll serve one up. And here we go. Here we are. That's how this is the addiction. So I played 2 games with him. We split. And I had played with my normal paddle that I always play with, putting it back in my bag. And I went, oh, I was playing with my doubles paddle. So it makes me think it doesn't really matter at the level I'm at, where the ounces are. There's bigger fish to fry in my singles game. If I'm hitting perfect ground strokes and I never make a mistake, then all right, maybe I can start thinking about that. But maybe I don't really need the dedicated singles paddle. That was kind of the result of that. But I have one, which is weighted exactly like you just talked about. I have a lot of lead on the very top and a little bit on the sides. And it feels a little more club-like. It feels like something I could really swing. But I don't need more power. I need more control and a better thought process on the court. And ain't no lead gonna fix that for me.
Well, here's a scenario you guys should be fortunate enough to be in someday. I was warming up for singles in Vegas a couple of years ago. I had my 10-ounce paddle with the weight at the top. And one thing led to another. And all of a sudden, I find myself playing a rec game with Ben and Colin Johns. And all I have in my hand is my 10-ounce singles paddle. You want to talk about neurotic for the next 15 minutes.
Right.
You know, like, I'm like, I got, it was my first time on court with Ben and Colin, and I've got the wrong paddle in my hand, and my other one was 400 yards away, and muddled through, learned a few things, but that was an unfortunate downside of the single specific paddle.
Yeah, that's weird. That just happened to me last Thursday, so I totally get where you're coming from.
Ben and Colin were?
Yeah, with Ben and Colin.
Yeah. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah.
And I was like, bro, I got you, you know. I think that's it, guys. Thanks so much for hanging out with us for a Q&A show. Scott, I know you have to get back on court, as you do. You guys go out and have some fun playing some pickleball this weekend. I think it seems like a great idea.
And don't forget to dominate or something like that.
But have a good time or fun or whatever. Whatever Darren says. Guys, thanks so much. As always, go enjoy yourselves. Talk to you next time. Keep on rocking.
Thank you for listening to 4.0 to Pro. For more tips, find us on Instagram at 4.0topro. If you have a pickleball question, submit it at picklehelp.com. Now, get out there and dominate. But don't forget to have fun.